Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today, I'm welcomed by my friend and confidant, Jay Villar. Hey, Jay, how
Hello,
you doing?
Hello, Aaron. I'm doing great. It's good to be back.
Hey, it's always fun to have you on.
Oh, thank you.
Jay, look a little bit about your background. Jay is the founder and practitioner of Nourish, a bespoke consulting company with a mission to educate, teach, and train people on the benefits of using food to heal your body and optimize your health. Jay has always been at the forefront of using optimal health techniques and biohacking his nutrition to achieve remarkable results in his career. Last fall, Jay completed a fellowship at the Rodale Institute and has since moved to the cold and snowy Northeast up here in Boston, Massachusetts.
Snowing in March.
Love it. Yeah. Nice, love it. But that's why you took a little trip. You went down to Florida, got away from it all.
How'd
that go?
I got a little sunshine, little vitamin D on the beach.
That's nice. Was it fun?
It was a great time. You know, if folks that are in the midst of winter and we're just indoors and you're outside and you're warm again and your feet are just walking around those sands and you're being refreshed by the ocean and it's like the dead of winter in your hometown, it's just like this mind-boggling idea that, holy cow, I can actually be warm. So being cold is actually a choice at that point.
Yeah. You can take a deep breath, relax a little bit.
All the things,
You can. Those vacations matter as much for the body as the mind, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, hey, let's ask this. When you go on your trips, what do you eat? Do you binge eat on junk food and get away from it all, pound some booze, or do you focus on your nutrition? And how do you deal with that?
Yeah, so, right. So, great question. I get this a lot. Like, you know, what do I eat, right? And pretty much, like, everyone is on their own journey when it comes to their health and their nutrition and what they're trying to do. So, to keep it simplified, I would say you're on like three different paths. You're either on your healing path, you're on your maintenance path, or you're on your whatever path, right? So currently for me, right, I'm on my maintenance path. I'm not necessarily working towards anything currently at the moment. I'm pretty at the, you know, weight that I want to be at, the energy level that I want to be at, and it took something to get there, right? So if I'm going to go out, like there's some variances that I'm going to be, you know, a lot of myself. So I went to dinner with my partner and some of his friends, and you know, I enjoyed a very, you know, nice glass of wine, and it was my friend's birthday, so you know, he ordered cake and I had a piece of the cake, and it was absolutely delicious, you know. But if I was, you know, working on something where, you know, my gut was completely compromised and I needed to, you know, work towards that, right, then my strategy would be different. You know, I would probably order club soda and probably pass on any, you know, sugar sort of sweets, but that's not where I am currently right now. So again, right, so it's not looking at, you know, the tactic as far as like what did you have to eat versus what somebody else had to eat. It's what's your strategy, you know, what's your strategy for your health right now, and then you can apply that towards wherever that is. So if your strategy is like you want to eat well in your home environment, and then when you go on vacation, you just like let caution out the wind and you feel fine after you get back and you can, you know, rest and recover, and that works for you, then like, great, you know, then awesome.
Nice. It's a mindset. It's a setting a plan, and it looks like it's working for you. You look svelte. You look healthy. You got a nice glow about yourself. You're on a magazine cover recently.
I was. Natural,
good for you, dude.
Natural Awakenings magazine.
Right on.
It was during my fellowship at Rodale. They found me about the work that I do with nutrition and plants, and then how I apply that to the soil. And they're like, let's write something up here. So it was quite the honor.
Hey, on vacation, did you eat any fermented or pickled food while you were out there?
Oh, you know, there were some pickles, pickled pickles.
Pickled pickles.
There were some pickled pickles that I...
Pickled cucumbers.
That I definitely like enjoy. And as far as fermented foods, it's definitely a conversation that I have with my clients about how to get the appropriate sources of the right probiotics in our bodies. When we eat fermented foods, it's greater than taking a probiotic pill because it's actually alive, you know, and different probiotic foods have different, you know, sources for us. But if anything that's fermented, that has turned the corner for it to, you know, have that live culture that we're now ingesting, it's going to incredibly impact our gut flora in a very positive way.
Yeah, lots of positive cultures that we can put in our body from that cold-fired food by actually the process of engaging those microorganisms, which are 10 times the amount of cells of microorganisms in our own body than we have of our own cells. It's crazy, right?
That's right.
Let me share a little bit of my journey with the fermentation.
Please.
So, well, a few years ago, I read a few books on this, on the healthy benefits of fermented foods. And then I attended a NOFA, which is a Northeast Organic Farming Association, went to a couple of their segments. It was a whole track on pickling vegetables. So I decided my family needed to eat more fermented foods. And the benefit of those bugs, obviously, as we talked about, are hard work and fermenting the food. Not only they taste great and have lots of diversity, but it's damn good for us, right? They got a symbiotic relationship of this coal-fired food, which have created by these bugs breaking down into a fermenting process. And it's as old as time, but it does make us healthy no matter where we are in progressive mindset of healthcare, right?
That's right. Every culture has something version of their fermented food, so they're onto something.
We've evolved to work together no matter where we come from. And better yet, you know, we are a little of this microorganisms are very similar to those that are in our own gut that we make from our kombucha or from cheese or beer or wine and really anything that uses this age old value add that we eat. And so I was decided that the good idea for my kids to eat this as well. So I was trying to limit my kids' intake of beer to only a few drinks per week, of course, right? Maybe no more than a case, of course. So I had to find something else. It couldn't just be beer.
Such a strict dad.
Yeah, that's what the doc says. So I had to listen. So we were looking for the heart healthy element. I decided that the best thing we could do for my family was if we consume mass amounts of pickles. You know, and it's not the stuff that you find in the shelves either, because unless it's shipped and stored cold, then we have preservative added, right? So we got to find the stuff that are looking for these good microorganisms in the cold case. Definitely more expensive, but worth it. Sorry, I got I'm a bit of a crazy zealot in some circumstances. Maybe people would still consider me that, as that crazy zealot. When I first started, no doubt about it, I was basically force feeding my kids pickles. Maybe it would be equivalent to be like a popcorn diet or whatever the next silver bullet food category in your diet that you have one specific segment that you're focused on. And in my case, it was only pickles that we would, I decided that we would change our life forever, right?
Yes.
Good plan, Niederhelmann. That's smart. End result, my kids feared me. They feared pickles. They'd run every time we'd open the fridge. So the fear of daily dose of pickles was a clear and present danger for my 5 and 7 year olds at the time. I basically ruined some of that fermented food for everyone in the family because of my zealot aspect of it. But Jay, what the hell's wrong with me, right? I got problems. I got to figure this out. I'm grown as a man. I figured these out, and we take a combination of different types of fermented food and also probiotics involved in that. Good place to start the conversation today,
great,
right?
Great, Clark. I see where you're going here.
Yeah, good cue up, right?
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
So let me read a little bit of a bio of our guest today. So over the past 10 years, John Cianfrani has traveled the world in pursuit of unique stories and creative ways to tell them. He's been involved in all aspects of capturing and curating these stories through documentary film and television. From episodes of Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown and the PBS Netflix program Mind of a Chef, John Cianfrani has worked as a producer, a director, and editor for this New York-based company, 0.0 Production. Additionally, John has directed a featured documentary film called Fermented, which is scheduled to air online in short order. It was hosted by Chef Edward Lee, and it was filmed to pose the question, what is fermentation? And this went to chefs and artisans in the West Coast, Chicago, and rural Japan. It was a fantastic movie. It was very informative. So that was a great opportunity for Jay, you and I to see this. And today it gives us a chance to talk to the director. Welcome, John. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Doing great. It was like a world-class trip watching the movie.
It was, yeah. Well, it was great for us too. I mean, I was mentioning earlier that I going into this film, I didn't know anything about what fermentation actually was. How it happened, what the science was behind it. So we kind of went in there trying to answer that question. Along the way, I think that we kind of realized you know, the science of it, while it's important and while it's something that you can dive really deep into, isn't necessary to understand in order to enjoy and create your own fermented products. It's one of those things where, you know, I think we mentioned in the film too, a bunch of people mentioned is if our great-grandmothers and their grandmothers knew how to do it well before we even had a concept of what microorganisms were, then you know, then we can do it too. It's great that we understand on a microscopic level what's going on to a degree, but there's still a lot more to figure out. But in the meantime, we can still just produce and enjoy these ingredients.
Well, yeah, what did you see from that balance of art and science? So you had a chance to meet with 7 or 8 different individuals that were all different food categories. Did you see a commonality in the individuals you talked to of being this artistic mentality?
Yeah, I think it was they were all patient. They were all I think able to let go of certain elements of control, except for maybe the beer makers. I feel like the cheese makers and the bread maker, soy sauce, kimchi, it's really about setting up the environment and then letting the microorganisms and the vegetables themselves do the work. But with beer, it seems like there's such a different kind of perspective and take on it. It's so much more controlled than the other elements of fermentation. And so many different opportunities to intervene in what the flavor profile is going to be and what the alcohol content is going to be. So I think that, you know, for the most part, they were able, it's about learning how to let go. But then for some reason with beer, it seemed like it was more about, at least with these guys, who are Nick Floyd and Jay Marzuski from Chicago, Three Floyds Brewery and Mars Brewery Company. They were all about the science. So I don't know. There was like a through line of just understanding that you have to be connected to your environment in order to make it work. And I thought that was kind of a valuable lesson takeaway from everybody that we talked to across the country and then on the other side of the world. It seemed like a common theme.
And John, what would you say the sort of their health was like? Like, how was their, you know, vitality, their energy? Were they, you know, practicing what they preach as far as, you know, having fermentation as, you know, part of their diet?
For sure. I mean, especially the beer drinkers. They were definitely partaking in the fermented diet, if you know what I'm saying. But I think, you know, Ed Lee mentioned to me, I don't know if while we were on the road, it's when he's traveling, doing a book tour for his new book, Buttermilk Graffiti. He's always on the road, you know, going to conferences, and he's got a restaurant in Louisville and a restaurant in D.C. and another one in Virginia. So he's on the move a lot, and he mentioned to me that the first thing he wants to do when he gets home is eat something fermented. Usually it's kimchi. It's just, I don't know if it's like a nostalgia thing or a body memory thing or just something that he enjoys, or just a familiar tradition when he's out on the road. But the first thing he does is go back to, you know, a fermented thing, just to like settle his stomach and calm him down and relax him. So I think there is something to that. Everyone seemed pretty healthy. I think that one thing is that a lot of people were telling us, even the people who are making kombucha and the pickles, was that you can't just eat fermented ingredients, and fermentation is not a panacea of anything that ails you, but it is something that you can use in conjunction with a balanced diet, with exercise, that helps to, you know, improve your overall health. But it's hard to quantify how much, you know, just fermentation can do for you healthfully. It's all connected, and I think that that's, you know, I think that's an important takeaway too.
Yeah, the introduction of all types of biodiversity right into our own health and microflora, as we talked about, is essential. And so, John, for you, did you get under the hood and explore the health benefits for yourself? Did your own movie have an impact on your eating habits?
For sure, for sure.
Beer's the easy one, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But one thing I did learn while filming with soy sauce makers in Japan was that a lot of the mass market soy sauce, the majority of it, is cut with alcohol.
Hmm.
And so the one that we were filming with didn't use any alcohol. I guess it's a flavor thing, maybe a preservative thing as well. But I always look for soy sauce that has no alcohol in the ingredients. And it, you know, it does just taste better. It doesn't have that, you know, alcoholic flavor. But it still has that tang and the deep umami kind of profile. So, you know, there was that as far as ingredients. I make my own sauerkraut as well. It's just so easy, just using whatever's left over in the refrigerator, putting it in the closet for, you know, a week or 2 weeks, just testing it along the way as it evolves through its fermentation process and putting it in the fridge when it's ready at the level that my wife and I both like. What else are we doing? I've tried to brew a couple of beers. We have a small apartment in New York, so it's not very conducive for that process. So, I don't know. I try and include it in all of my meals now in one way or another, whether it's like a breakfast smoothie with kefir or yogurt, or, you know, just lunch, putting a couple pieces of kimchi or, you know, sauerkraut on the side. It has become kind of, I feel like my meal is missing something without it.
It's interesting because there are so many different food categories affected this, and Michael Pollan defined it, and this is the terminology when he looked at his book Cooked, and he looked at how man has evolved based off of using these different methods of preparing food. He called fermentation cold fire, using bugs and microorganisms. And John, in your movie, which is quite interesting, you explored a lot of these living microbes and the effect on these food categories, the value add, that capacity, from beer, miso, bread, pickles, salami, kombucha, cheese, and more. You explore the impact of food on our lives and how that is made. And I guess the question I have for you is, what was the most surprising thing you learned in that entire adventure?
How simple it is if you set up the right environment to have fermentation. I think the most surprising thing was fermentation is infinitely complex, but you don't have to do too much to make it work. So it's you just have to tap into the wavelength, and you can get amazing results. I thought it was going to be some crazy amount of ingredients. It's just, you know, with bread, for example, it's flour, water, and salt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, for sourdough bread, that's all you need, and heat and time. So it's amazing how so few ingredients can create such complex flavors. Milk is rennet, salt, and milk. And you can get amazing cheese with time, and you just let the environment around it flavor it for you.
So speaking of this sort of simplicity that makes fermentation so, you know, delicious, especially when you do it, you know, in purest way that you were able to film it, has it sort of changed your perspective as far as, you know, what sort of faux fermented foods are available out there on the market and pass for fermented foods, i.e. like sauerkraut that you'll find at a baseball game, or, you know, pickles that come with your, you know, burger that aren't necessarily fermented?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is something, it's tough sometimes to avoid it if you're eating out or, you know, going to fast food. But in my home, I try to keep it real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we make as much as we can in the space that we have, and you know, we buy what we can. But one of the problems is that it's so expensive to find like real fermented ingredients in a lot of places. So it's kind of prohibitive in a lot of ways. And I think that the preservatives infused pickles are you know, are there because they're less expensive, and so more people can buy them. So I think that, you know, things need to be done to make it more more affordable. But I try and keep it as close to fermented as possible in my home. But there are some challenges with it along the way too.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Keep it real. That's good stuff. So Jay, as stated earlier, John C. and Franny has also worked on as either a producer, a director, an editor of or post-producer of every episode and every season of the multi-Emmy award-winning series Mind of a Chef, which we think we've both seen numerous different episodes. And over the course of 8 years, the show is filmed in places that are with well-known chefs in different places and given opportunity to travel to places like Japan and Senegal and Sweden, Faroe Islands, amongst others. So, John, what was the most rewarding part of that show?
I think it was working with chefs who are at the top of their industry, who have philosophies, who have a deep knowledge of tradition, who want to share those traditions and stories with other people, whether it's through the food they cook or through, you know, their stories of the food they cook. One of the chefs that I, you know, had an amazing experience with was Magnus Nilsson in Sweden. He has written a number of books. He wrote one that's the Swedish Cookbook, which is an 800-page tome of recipes. He wrote one about his restaurant. I think he's working on one about his about Swedish and Scandinavian bread, the Nordic Cookbook. Sorry, not Swedish Cookbook, Nordic Cookbook. One of the places he took us to was the Faroe Islands, where we met with this family who lives on an island which is part of the Faroe Islands, which is, I think, governed by Denmark, but it's out, you know, somewhere in between Iceland and Denmark in the Atlantic Ocean. There's an island in this group of islands where a family lives, a family of five, with a teacher who gets helicoptered in every week to teach their children. They're sheep farmers. And then they also, what they do with some of the butchered sheep is they hang it in a slatted barn on the island, and because of the climate and the humidity, the relative humidity through the year, they just let it air ferment. So it just hangs out in these slatted barns and turns into this crazy, funky, fermented sheep. You know, just meeting with people like that who live these really, you know, unique lives, unique lifestyles, trying to preserve traditions and, you know, keep them alive in the way that they happened, and, you know, trying to bring that message to more people, I think was one of the most rewarding experiences of working on the show. So
John, you mentioned that some of these, you know, master chefs that you were able to also work with, you know, have this underlying philosophy about, you know, life and being a chef. So, you know, as an amateur chef that likes to, you know, cook my own food whenever I can, and for, you know, for all the amateur chefs that are out there listening, what would you say some of those, you know, common philosophies are that could like illuminate the way that we think about, you know, our food and how we prepare it for our loved ones on our dinner tables?
I think ingredients are key. And keeping the and locality is also important. Kind of keeping in tune with the seasons, and respecting that maybe you shouldn't always be able to have a strawberry. Maybe you know, you can enjoy it when it's the season for it. And when it's not, you can enjoy the season of other ingredients whose seasons it is for them. So I think it's, I don't know, it's a lot of these, a lot of the chefs are just kind of trying to tell stories and make food with the ingredients of their home, the ingredients that are available, and trying to make people appreciate, you know, the simplicity of a lot of the ingredients, and a lot of times just enjoying, you know, again, going back to Magnus, he had one like little appetite, like little snack that he would serve his guests, where they would go out to the farm, which is right outside their kitchen, grab a bunch of field peas and put them on, you know, put them on a plate for their guests. And it's just minutes away from being picked, minutes from being picked, and just, you know, presenting it in a way that's just enjoy, you know, what this is. It's like it can never get any fresher, and, you know, it's got enough going on for it that we don't have to dress it up too much. So I think sometimes, you know, the simplest things can be the most rewarding if you can, you know, take a moment and understand why.
Oh, yeah. I remember when I first grew my first basil plant, and I was like, I'm going to make the best basil and tomato mozzarella salad. And, like, believe me, everybody knew that I grew that basil.
Uh-huh.
And it was delicious.
Yeah. There's a lot of pride there. And it
a lot of pride,
be.
Yeah.
And, I mean,
yeah.
Things do taste better when you grow them. There's
of course,
no doubt.
Definitely.
And I think that's something we can incubate in conversations with our kids, too. I mean, this is something that we can return back to the Victory Garden idea.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of values to that, because it teaches you not just about the incredible flavors of hyper-local delicious food that you've grown, but you have an appreciation for what it takes to actually grow this food.
That's right. Yeah. If you're not going to grow your own food, at least support the ones that do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it also teaches you to respect the environment. Like, you have to respect the ground that you're growing these in. So I think it just kind of instills in you a philosophy of, you know, respecting other things around you too.
And I'll say that, you know, John, a shout out to your work with Mind of a Chef in that specific episode on the Faroe Islands. I distinctly remember that. It was beautifully done. And I remember that family in their aging room. I can still picture that. As you were describing, it was easily pictured in my mind. I remember also that they went out, I think it was on the side of cliffs, to pull off eggs, right?
Yeah.
For gulls? That was...
What were they? They were I forget the name of the birds, but they as a defense mechanism, they vomit on you when you reach for their eggs.
Yeah.
Did you get vomited on?
No, I didn't. That was a crazy day. I don't think we realized what sort of danger we were getting put into. Everyone got away, you know, came away fine, but there were some hairy moments. Huh. I just remember when, you know, preparing to go over there and talking about how we were going to go hike for these birds' eggs. I said, do we need any special equipment, any special gear? They said, no, all you need are some good boots. And as long as you're not afraid of heights, you'll be fine. Coming from, you know, me being like, I've now lived in, you know, cities for the last 20 years, haven't really, you know, gone on major expeditions or anything. I took their word for it. Come to find out that, you know, we're walking on these 1 foot wide wet grass paths that have a sheer cliff down into the Atlantic Ocean. And that was like the easy part of it. They're like running around in like rubber boots, you know, climbing up and down these hills. You know, it's their home. It's like they know that island backwards and forwards. Mm-hmm. So to them, it's like it's a Sunday hike. But to us, or to me at least, it was a life. We felt really good afterwards that we made it.
that food tasted much
that
better.
That better be the best eggs I've ever had in my life.
Yeah,
because I was only giving my life to those eggs.
Yeah.
In fact,
it is a you know, infamously dangerous profession, bird's egg collecting, which, you know, is a tradition in the Faroe Islands.
And what's the cost of that plate? Like, if somebody's at this restaurant, is it like $1,000? Because that's what I would charge.
They kept it for themselves.
Oh,
they didn't,
okay.
Yeah, those were
priceless.
You know, that was priceless. Just for themselves. It used to be the main economy on that island, or even in the Faroe Islands. But in the last century, it's transitioned to sheep farming.
Okay.
So it used to be, I think it was like 80% bird's eggs and puffins, puffin catching, and now it's it's sheep farming.
Yeah. In fact, when I was watching the new Star Wars movie where Luke Skywalker lives, it reminded me of the island, in fact, where he's out in the middle of nowhere on the side of the cliff. I was thinking of your episode, in fact.
I thought it was, and yeah. I had to look it up. I think they said it was, I think it's Ireland that they filmed that.
Yeah, it was nearby, definitely in that same era, same genre area. So, John, I read that you also produced the final episode of Parts Unknown, which focused on the Lower East Side. You profiled a diverse allotment of artists, musicians, filmmakers who have seen the area of New York City change drastically since the 1970s, and each shared a meal with some interesting stories about their place that they call home with Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah.
And now I was a fan of the show Parts Unknown. I'd say that, you know, we watched, I think my wife and I watched basically every episode of that. And it seems that no matter his sarcasm or sharp wit in this, in what you found in the post-production voiceover, he was always a gracious guy to the folks that welcomed him in the places, even in situations of that banana hammock wearing guy in Sicily that was throwing the frozen squid into the diving situation.
Oh, man. That was bad. Yeah,
that was crazy. That was hilarious. He was very cordial at game time, basically. And so my wife and I felt like, at a while, you know, I think everyone probably says we never met the man, but we felt like, you know, you could get an idea of who he really connected with.
Yeah.
And it became evident, it seemed, that he was really able to mesh with all types of folks. And really, that would seem to be his special, unique skill set, was that of being able to intertwine himself and get that human interest story. And in watching your episode in the Lower East Side, that appeared to be the case. He seemed to be engaged with each and every character you brought to the table. So what was it like to be the one that curated how to capture those interactions?
You know, that was his dream team of people he wanted to meet with in New York. Those are all his heroes that he listened to. So it was really, it was an honor to, you know, to help him to experience those conversations with all those people. He basically drafted a list at the beginning during pre-production of everybody who he wanted in the episode. And 9 out of 10 of them said yes right away. So he was a one of a kind guy, and people jumped at the chance to talk to him and converse with him about, you know, all sorts of subjects. So his reputation and his perspective made my job very easy, I gotta say. Like, there was not a lot of convincing that needed to go on between, you know, the people who we filmed with. They were just excited to chat with him about, you know, about the Lower East Side of the 70s and 80s. So it was a fun experience. It was great to meet some of those people as well. But, you know, it was obviously tinged with a lot of sadness afterwards, because we were just getting started into post-production when he passed. Mm. So we had to rethink how we were going to create the episode. And, you know, hopefully it's something that he would have liked. So, I don't know.
It was very well done, and I think
thank you.
It was a nice homage to him. Definitely, it was a situation that I think you could tell from those interactions. And I didn't see the B-roll of the clips that didn't, you know, that got cut on the floor, but everything seemed to be just that same kind of engaging personality. It was well done. Now let me ask this though: what was it like behind the camera? Was he? I know he was a perfectionist. I hear he was a perfectionist. Could he challenge you for the folks that were behind the camera, and also for the ones that were queuing this up for him?
You know, the show was so well run, and everyone kind of knew what they were doing. It was just working with the best people in the business for that kind of programming. The director, Michael Steed, has worked with him for years, and they understood each other perfectly well. There was so little friction during the entire shoot, during the entire thing. He was getting the scenes that he wanted and the conversations that he wanted, and, you know, it was kind of a really surprisingly smooth shoot. It didn't help that it was New York, and everybody who's on the crew is from New York. So there wasn't the challenge of coordinating, you know, all the equipment being shipped across the world, the crews, hotels, transportation, you know, finding scenes in another country while you're working out of an office in New York. So there were certain things that were to our advantage as far as production. But really, it was where he wanted to be and who he wanted to be with. So he was enjoying the whole thing.
All you had to worry about was bringing in some good fermented food for everybody to enjoy.
That's right. That's right.
All right. So your movie Fermented premiered at the Seattle and Napa Film Festivals and most recently took top honors at the Life Sciences Film Festival in Prague, Czech Republic, as I'm dating us back. You received some great acclaim for that, and your television work can be found throughout cable and Netflix and numerous media outlets. What else can we expect to see from you in coming years? What's next for you, John?
Hopefully many, many things. I would love to do something again about Fermented. That was the one challenge with the film was, like you mentioned, Jay, earlier, that there's fermentation in every culture around the world. So there's a lot more that we can explore, a lot more flavors, a lot more stories to tell. I would love to keep doing it. We'll see if that happens. Otherwise, I'd love to do something about farming.
Hmm.
Maybe spend a year tracking, a season in the dirt. I don't know. There's other things coming up, but I'm not really able to discuss them at the moment. But those are some wishes, some things that I'd love to do again.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to seeing what's next. It's always great storytelling from everything I've seen. Jay, final thoughts?
Yeah, John. So if you can have somebody start one fermented food in their home, where would a beginner begin?
I'm going to go with the, in the film we talked to Sander Katz, and he does this, what he calls krautchi, which is essentially taking all of the vegetables that you have left over in your fridge, chopping them up, salting them a little bit, crushing them and bruising the cellular walls so that they leak water, leak juice, and then putting it in a jar submerged in their own juices, putting a lid on it, and then letting it go. It's the simplest thing you can do, and it's delicious. And just start with the simplest thing.
Yeah, I love it.
And then you can start adding in, whatever spices you want. Start with krautchi, Sander Katz's krautchi.
It addresses so much food waste. We throw away so much food because we don't know what to do with it. And now we can just ferment it and be fermented experts.
That's right.
That's right.
And I'll say, watching that, I way underbruised my coal fire
stuff.
Oh, you
got to bruise
the crap really out do. Of it. You yeah. pound yeah. that stuff. He was all over it.
Yeah.
So, well, John C. and Franny, I thank you so much for taking the time to partake in today's conversation. I learned a great deal.
I did too.
I know our listening audience will as well. So I'll just thank you. And until next time, we look forward to speaking with you soon.
All right. Can I plug our website real quick?
Of course. Right? Yes.
So if anybody wants to sign up on fermentedfilm.com, we can let them know as soon as the film is available for sale. The pre-sale for Fermented on Vimeo starts on 3/29. That's March 29th, and it's going to be available to download on April 5th. And then, so go to fermentedfilm.com and sign up, and we can let you know as soon as that's available and send you the link and everything.
Fantastic. I'll put a link at the bottom of the write-up and in our iTunes account.
Okay, cool.
But, John, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks, Jay.